Welcome to this lecture on Christian Science. I'm going to introduce the lecturer and then give him the floor. Alex Fisher was trained in the law, and he worked for 4 years with American firms in Paris. And he loved the law. He probably still does, I assume. When he was actually 11 years old, he bought his first legal textbook, believe it or not. So if you need a lawyer, I guess that's the kind of lawyer you want. And as he grew in his understanding of the law, he also grew in his understanding of Christian Science. And he decided at one point that he would devote his career to Christian Science. And he moved to Boston, worked with the headquarters of the Christian Science Church there, and then back to his native Paris, where he became a full-time Christian Science practitioner, and which he does today. And he's also a member of the Christian Science Board of Lectureship and gives lectures like this throughout the world. First Church of Christ Scientist Geneva is honored to have him here to speak on this, how spiritual perception brings healing. And I should also say, in keeping with the theme of this Geneva Book Fair, he'll talk, I'm sure, about one of the most revolutionary books in the world, Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures, by Mary Baker Eddy, the discoverer and founder of Christian Science. So, Alex. Thank you,
please. Good afternoon. And I'm going to make an offer. If you'd like to come closer so we can be closer, you can move, but if you'd rather stay in the back, that's fine. But otherwise, there is room. All good? So the sound is okay? So I don't think it'll surprise you too much, but today at the Geneva Book Fair, I'll be talking about a book. So we'll be discussing a book. The title of the book is, as Keith said, it's here, it's also in French, but in English it's Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures. And the author is Mary Baker Eddy, and we'll talk about her a bit more. So why this book, and why is relevant for us in this book? Well, I found, as an avid reader of the book, and you'll see it's also a spiritual practice, so as a practitioner of this spirituality and as a reader, I found maybe three reasons why the book makes sense today. One, the book does help us make peace more of a friend, less of a stranger that comes through our life from time to time, but we can find actual peace. And I would push it even more by saying that we can find peace even at times where really things are not peaceful, and we're dealing either with a physical challenge or situation at home or somewhere else. Well, the book shows how we can find durable, actual peace. So that's one idea. The second idea is that this book offers ways to find solutions to pretty much everything that life can throw at us. Any challenges at work, any finance challenges, health challenges. The book doesn't tell us what to do, but it shows us a way of thinking, a way of looking at life that does help us find solutions. And I'll share examples. And maybe the last point, the last idea that makes the book relevant, is that it tells us and shows us a bit about, or gives us a definition of what God is in a way that makes sense. I don't know about you, but very often I come across definition of God that don't speak to my heart, and it offers a definition of what God is in a way that is, I think, rational, if I can dare using that word. So I say it is a practical book. It has a practical spirituality. So let's start with a practical example. This example comes from a reader that I know very well, because this reader is my mom. And this is what happened to her and to me at the same time. At the time of my birth, the doctors came to see my parents, and they did not come with a big smile, quite the opposite. they said that they had run some tests. I was losing blood, and they found that I had a stomach perforation. So they took over the case, and they decided to transfer me to the children's hospital, because I could not be operated in this hospital, so I had to be moved. So both my parents are readers of this book. I've been practicing those ideas for some time. And what my mom explains is that, in a way, she knew what to do in this situation. And what she knew what to do was, in a way, to try to move away as much as she could from all those fearful thoughts, all the diagnosis, the prognosis. You can almost imagine the little thunderstorm in thought that happens when such a news is given to you. She knew that she had to somewhat move away from those negative thoughts, very dark thoughts, to try to embrace more of what she was understanding of what God is. And I'm jumping ahead a tiny bit, but we'll see that how we think, what we hold in thought, our state of consciousness has a big impact not only on our body, but on our life. So she knew it was very critical that, in a way, she does not worry too much about what was going on outside, but that her thought was really very important to be taken care of. And she does explain that in the middle of this mental thunderstorm, she had a sense of God as universal, infinite love. The love that we all express, well, that love as a source, and that was God to her. A source of God as infinite goodness. In a way, I think it is hard to be standing here today and pretend to explain what God is. I think what the book teaches us is that we find out God by, like, little touch, that we can find more and more about what God is. And so that was her little touch. But that was enough to bring a bit more peace. And so she persisted into looking away from the diagnosis into getting a clearer sense of God. And she explained that she felt at peace, a deep sense of peace. And so much so that that night she was able to fall asleep. She slept through the night, which was quite remarkable given the circumstances. The next morning, the doctor came to see my dad at the second hospital. And the doctor was very puzzled because he said that they had run some more tests. I had not been given any medical treatment or anything. I was just transferred. They had run some tests and there was no more blood loss and they could not find any trace of the stomach perforation. I mean, he had been diagnosed some hours before and they could not find anything. And so they've asked that I would stay a bit longer in the hospital and those things. But the truth is, that was the end of it. I had more checkups, more things medically done, but that was the end of it. The doctors were so puzzled that they could not rejoice, but of course my parents rejoiced. And they rejoiced because they understood that that was not a miracle. It does look like a miracle, but if we pause for a second, a miracle is something that is quite astonishing happening. So at this point, that's okay, that's a miracle. But something astonishing happening, but we don't understand why it happened. And they knew it was not a miracle because they had seen similar healings. They had read other healings. So they knew that this, that in a way, their way of thinking, their way of understanding about more about what God is, could bring this result. So they rejoiced, and that was the end of it. That was the healing, and it has been permanent, as I can humbly testify right here. So it's a great healing, and it's a great healing, and you'll see that there are many similar healing. But to me, the key question is, I said that it's not a miracle. Well, fine, but how does it work? If it's not a miracle, how does it work? To explain a bit how it works, I cannot go into all details because it takes time and it takes some study, but just maybe there are three main ideas that we need to look into to understand how everything works. The first idea is, yes, this idea of God, to refine our sense of God. And so when the book mentions the idea of God, it's the idea of an infinite principle of something universal. It is not the God of a small group or the God of a church. It is, in a way, like mathematics. We could imagine that we don't know about mathematics, and some of us would discover mathematics. Well, this principle of mathematics is available for everyone, and it does bring a sense of order and harmony in anybody applying it. Well, that's how the book understands what God is, this reliable principle, this source of harmony. The Bible says that God is spirit. To me, it speaks to the substance of God. There is no molecules or atoms in God. It is completely spiritual. That's the substance of God. It is the infinite spirit. It has no limits. I said we could paint a mental picture of God by little touches. So we could take from the Psalms, for example. Psalm 23 says, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want." So the idea of shepherd, which convey not an idea of a bearded man and us being sheep, but more an idea of protection, care, something that, yes, is not visible to the senses, but is present and available. And to me, what I found interesting is that as much as mathematics can seem absent to our life, if I say, well, I don't believe in mathematics and I'm not interested to learn about it, well, it won't govern my life. The minute I say, well, I mean, this is interesting, then suddenly it takes over my life. That's the same with God. It's always available. It just takes us, in a way, taking a step to try to discover and understand a bit about what it means. That's the main idea. The second idea is a clear understanding of who we are. And I don't mean about what we see in the mirror when we wake up in the morning, but deeply who we are. And the picture painted by the book is the idea, which is very universal. Again, it's not ideas for people sitting in this room or just the Christians or just those guys. It's really, we're talking about something universal. And it's the idea that we are all deeply spiritual at the core, that we are spiritual. And here again, we can paint by little touches. And spiritual, we are absolutely innocent. So you may think, well, of course I'm innocent. I've not committed any crime. Yes, I'm innocent. Well, sometimes, at least I don't know about you, but me, sometimes when I'm faced with a difficulty or a challenge, I can be tempted to think, well, what did I do wrong to deserve this? Someone gets an extreme sickness and says, well, I didn't deserve this. What did I do? And there's this sense of self-condemnation that we are, in a way, responsible for the evil that comes into our life. Well, the fact is that what we are is deeply innocent. And then I could go on and on and on. Strength is natural. Harmony is natural. I think one English word that we could use is a sense of perfection. Not a sense of human perfection, but a sense of completeness, that there is basically nothing wrong with us. So that's the second idea. The third idea is going to answer the question you did not ask, which is, well, I like this idea of perfection, but honestly, it doesn't look like my life. My life is maybe a bit of a mess or total mess or sometimes a mess. And so the third question answer this point about how can we make this real? How can this really be? Is this just like a new rosy idea that makes no sense? So how can it be really not naive but tangible? And that third question is, what is reality? What is real? And now you may think, well, I'm lost now. I don't see the connection. Well, you'll see. There's a connection. What is reality is a question that has been asked by philosophers and others. And I have a quote right here, or it should be right here. It's actually over there. It's the one who started this asking this question is the French philosopher René Descartes. And Descartes was a deep, deep thinker, very serious thinker, and he asked this question. He said, well, can I really trust the five physical senses? Because basically we know the world through at least the five physical senses. He said, can I really trust that to give me a true picture of reality? And through reasoning, Descartes found that not completely, it's not absolutely sure that actually, he said, no, there is lots of doubt that it's actually a true picture of reality. He used a very simple example. He says, a very basic example, he says, you see the sun moving in the sky. obviously the sun doesn't move, it's the earth that rotates around the sun, and those type of ideas to say, well, actually, if I want to be really sure about one thing, Descartes says, I can only be sure of the fact that I think. And if I think, therefore I am. But everything else is unclear. That's his famous quote, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. You may think, well, why do we really care about nature reality? I'm very happy with what I see. Well, that's fine. And a year ago, I was talking to an astrophysicist with the same questions, and what he was saying, I think I liked it. He said, well, we can live our life just like that. That's fine. But sometimes we hit a wall, and we're very happy to find a different perspective. And that's where we ask those deep questions. But yes, absolutely, we could continue living a life with a limited sense of things. But it's still worth to go deeper. And I was interested to see that in a British publication called The Lancet, with a top medical journal in England, they have an issue on neurology, and they've asked this very same question. And we'll see how it makes sense for us and why it's important for us. They ask this question. They say, do we perceive the world around us as it really is, or is the world an internal perceptual copy that is generated within our brain? Is the whole material world nothing more than a dream? So they don't say that what we seem to experience doesn't exist. They say, but what is the nature of what we see? And this is what this book pushes a bit more by saying that actually we see the product of our thinking. That what we experience is really the product of our thought. We're not responsible for the problem in the world, but we seem to be experiencing our state of thoughts, which in a way explains already a little bit, and we'll look into it a bit more, how prayer, a mental activity, something spiritual, can have an impact on our life, because our thinking and our life is completely connected. In the book, this is how the author says it, and I'll just read quickly from it. She says, hold thought steadfastly to the enduring, the good, and the true, and you will bring these into your experience proportionably to their occupancy of your thoughts. And when I found those ideas, it was very interesting to me to see actual either medical experiments or scientific experiments that point us in the direction of the impact of thinking on experience. An experiment I read not so long ago in the New England Medical Journal, I think that's the exact title, which is a publication in the U.S., was of a nocebo and placebo effect experience involving knee surgery. To make it short, there was a group of men which had problems walking involving the knee. So the paper described the experiment. So the problem was so bad that those people needed to have knee surgery in order to reduce the pain and to help with the walking. So that's what they did. But this was a placebo experiment. So when they agreed to the surgery, they also agreed to the experiment, which was that possibly they would get a fake surgery. So in practice, some of the group of men went through surgery and had the regular procedure. And another group was dressed up for surgery, went through the room. Their knee was even cut and then closed again to pretend it was a surgery, but no surgery was performed. None of the thing they were supposed to do to the knee, they've not done this. But they didn't know about it. They knew it could happen, but they didn't know if they would have the real surgery or the fake surgery. After that, they would give balms, and there would be follow-ups to see how they were doing. And the experiment shows, and that's very interesting, that the men who got the fake surgery reported as little pain and walked as well as the guys who had the surgery. And they did a follow-up just immediately after, and for a long period after, they just checked on those people. So again, they had less pain, and they were able to walk where no surgery was performed. The only thing that had changed, what was it? Well, they thought that they had gone through surgery. So you can see the impact on thinking on the body. And I'm sure you have examples of your own when you can see how thinking impacts the body. So that's the idea that our thought is the key thing. But the book goes a bit further, and there is another experiment in quantum physics, which I found very interesting too, where basically scientists found, and the experiment is called the double slit experiment, they found that a very, very small piece of matter, a photon, behaves differently when he is being observed or not observed. When there is someone to look at it or not to look at it, there is a different behavior. I won't go into the technicality of it, but when no one looks at it, it behaves as a wave and leaves a wave pattern on the wall. When someone looks, it behaves as a marble and hits the wall, leaving a pattern of a marble. So basically, the scientists have the same piece of matter, but two different behaviors, whether they make measurement or not measurement. I think it was Richard Feynman, who had a Nobel Prize, physics Nobel Prize, called the experiments extraordinary and could not be explained through Newton physics. They all see that it happens, but why, it's still being researched and there are various interpretations. But what I found helpful was to see that sometimes we think that the world out there is on its own and we're here thinking, where to me this experiment shows again how everything is connected, that our thinking does impact our life. And this is what, in a way, the author of this book was gradually coming to understand. It didn't come as a flash. It was a painful, long process. So the author of the book is Mary Baker Eddy. So this woman was a woman, and there was no small thing to be a woman in it was 19th century, early 20th century. And she had two main character traits. She was very Christian, so to her the Bible was important. But she had a really an intellectual search and a very inquisitive mind. She really wanted to understand. She was not ready to take things for granted. She was really, or at face value, she really wanted to understand how things work. And in a way, life made her understand things and forced her, because early on, she became very sick, to the point where she couldn't leave her bed for periods of times. So she resorted to medical care. It brought some relief, but didn't solve the thing. So then she didn't give up. So she looked into other alternative therapies of the time. So back then, there was still homeopathy. Already homeopathy was there. All types of different practices, hydrotherapy. And she got some relief, but not completely healed, but it helped her understand a bit more about the impact of thoughts on the body, especially with homeopathy, that does help to see the connection between thinking and body. But I would say the biggest experience arrived when she had an accident. She had an accident. She was left unconscious, and people feel she was losing her life. So she was brought to the house, and she naturally, I would say intuitively, asked for a Bible to pray when she regained consciousness somewhat. And what happened was that within 3 days, she found herself completely healed, where other people couldn't understand why she was healed. And here again, she did not want to leave this as a miracle. She felt something must have happened. And in a way, her research in homeopathy and all those alternative medicines prepared her thoughts to try and understand what happened. So she took the next 3 years of her life just to study more the Bible, just to go more deeply to try and understand why she had been healed. And she found many very interesting things. And in a way, what I found very interesting is that this book is really a religious book, but in the good sense of the term. What I mean by religious, it is very spiritual, but it has no dogmas, no forbidden things. It is really a deeply spiritual book, and that's one of the things she found. She found that the spirituality of Jesus was something that was very universal, that applied to everyone, but that nowhere it was about having other men dictate to others what they should do, nor was it to be seen as a list of the right thing to do or the wrong thing to do. In a way, it was going further to understand more about what our connection with the infinite is. And that's a route, that's a road on which we are just on our own with the infinite. Even if our neighbor is very spiritual, he's not here to tell us what to do. It's really about understanding. So for her, there was no more creeds, no more blind believing. It was really, to me, true religion or true spirituality, which is freedom. It's freedom and getting more and more freedom. Practically, more happiness, more sense of peace, more sense of purpose, more sense of quietness. It helps us being our better self. And to me, that's what it should be all about. So that's what she found. The other thing that is interesting is that when you look at what Jesus was reported as saying about his own spirituality, you see that the man was healing others. And when asked about how he healed others, he has, he says many things, but one other thing he says, it's in the Gospel of John, he says, "Verily, verily, I say unto you, he that believeth on me, he that understands me, the works that I do shall he do also." So Jesus is not saying that that he's like a superhero, we have to go to him, or that is there is some mystery. He says, no, actually, if you understand what I say, if you understand mathematics, you will bring order to your life. If you've never heard about mathematics, the math teacher may help you bring some order, but basically, you can do it on your own. So it does away with any sense of hierarchy. It also does away with a sense of pressure. We don't have to go fast or slow, we just go at our own pace to discover and see how those ideas make sense. And what's interesting and not very often talked about, although it's there in history, in books, is that if you look at the early Christian literature, and there's all types of things for the, let's say, first, second, third century, there's all types of good things, weird stuff, but you can see a line going through all those things, and those are the healings. You can see that people practicing the ideas of Jesus 150 years after, 250 years after, were expecting healings and were finding solutions and finding healings. So you could tell this spirituality is, as I say, it's like math, that you apply it, you practice it, and then you demonstrate it. And it seems, according to at least the research I've made of what scholars say, that around 325, around the time of the Council of Nicaea, it looks like there was less and less reports of healing. It looks like the church doctrine or the creeds grew stronger in terms of what you have to do, what you have to believe, but at the same time, the healings were less and less reported. And there were a few exceptions here and there throughout the centuries, but that was the end of it. And to me, it makes sense because this spirituality, to be effective, needs to be understood. It's not about believing anything. Actually, one of the first time I read the book, I had my big marker, and I was crossing things that were not making any sense, things that were talking to me, or things that were somewhat interesting, and that's how it needs to be practiced. Because if we go back to what we were saying, the key thing is that it's all about bringing a change in consciousness, that suddenly we leave a sense of fear and stress into a sense of more peace, more harmony, and this change in consciousness only happens through understanding. It's not about believing. If I believe 2 + 2 = 4, when things are pushed, I may not believe it equals 4 again. But when I understand it equals 4, you can do anything you want. It equals 4 as far as I'm concerned. So I said it is practical. So I've chosen two examples that I think are helpful, especially to explain a bit about what prayer he is, and to illustrate how this spirituality works. You'll see the first example is a physical healing, and the second is more relationship healing, but I find it very interesting. So the first example is a lady. It's a lady who called me one day, and she said she knew nothing about the book, nothing about this spirituality, nothing about Christian Science, and but she had been diagnosed with breast cancer, but she said she didn't like chemical stuff. She wanted to have something natural, and a friend had told her about the book, about this practice. So she asked if there's anything I could do, and she also, we could tell from her discussion, she indicated that she did not believe in God. That's how she said it. So again, that's okay not to believe in God, because the idea is to understand. It's not about believing. So we agreed not to use the term God, But we talked about the source, the her source with a capital S, that life has a source. God is life itself. So that's how we would refer to God. And in a way, my work with her had twofold. One, I needed to answer her questions as she was trying to understand things more. And also it was about praying. That was secondfold. It was how I was praying about the situation. So in my discussion with her, I clarified the idea that it was her own path, that she was discovering ideas and I could tell she was making progress. And for the prayer, I'm going to share how I prayed, but I'm going to make a little like a legal provision, like a statement, which is very important. It is that you'll see that prayer is something very spontaneous. I'm not going to give you a piece of paper with you should repeat those words. Actually, when Jesus was asked how to pray, he said, well, don't repeat words. Because, of course, repeating words doesn't change consciousness. So I'll just share how I prayed just as an example. But if you study the book a bit, you'll see that in practice, prayer is something new each time. Prayer is something very spontaneous. So I'll just share ideas that help me, but you'll find your own way within those guidelines to pray. And I would say really it's different each time. It's not something you repeat time after time. So I found four areas that help me pray in the right direction when I'm either faced with a challenge or when someone else is asking for help. The first thing I like to check in my thought when I'm faced with difficulty and I decide to pray is making sure that there is no sense of ego. That no one is good at prayer. It's not like Jesus was really good at prayer. There were amazing results. And if, again, we go back to what Jesus said, when asked, he said, I can do nothing of mine own self. So self is out of the way. It's not about ego. And you'll see, it'll bring a sense of relief, because what may happen sometime when we start praying, we may be tempted to feel a sense of burden. Say, oh, I need to pray about this. Okay, so I'll take the book. But that's not the point. The point is to really let ego out of the way. It's not about us doing something. It's less about expressing something than receiving. It's more about, it's not writing an email, it's more receiving an email. And the email being inspiration or spiritual ideas that come to our thought, any peace that comes to us, any idea that makes sense to us, this is what brings the healing. Jesus said, and again, I keep quoting him because that was, to me, the best practitioner of this spirituality. And he said, you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free. So it's knowing what is true, knowing the harmony beyond the appearance, that brings the healing, because it does bring a change of consciousness. So that's the first thing I do, is making sure that it's not us doing something, no sense of I'm going to do something, more sense of, okay, I'm getting quiet now, what do I need to know? What do I need to learn? It's more receiving something than trying to create something. And it is important, because it can be tempting, especially when we've had successful healing in the past. We may feel, well, I'm good at healing, so I'll pray again about this one. Well, it's always about letting go of any sense of ego. The second point, which I find helpful to remind myself when I begin to pray, and it will sound surprising, but I'll explain, it is to make sure that I'm not trying to heal something. Not trying to heal something. So you may say now, well, wait a minute, it makes no sense. The guy is sick, you're praying, he's going to be healed, so yes, you're trying to heal something. Well, in appearance, that's what it looks like. Yes, of course, there's a healing, but when we go, if we look from far, that's the case. But when you look more closely, it's never about trying to fix something. It's more about discerning what is already true beyond what the physical senses present. To be very clear, everyday life doesn't tell us about God. I mean, actually, when we go on our dates, we open the TV or rarely talk about God, or maybe if there's an exhibit, something about Egypt or something, but it's never there. Although it's like the air we seem to breathe, this principle is always present. So the idea is to discern beyond the appearance, the presence of this harmony. And it can be done. It's going, in a way, it's a bit like this reader I talked about, my mother, when she was hit with all the suggestions about the diagnosis, what would happen to her infant child, she made an effort to really go beyond the appearance to grasp in a clearer way, a sense of God. And the sense of God, not in abstract way, sense of God that makes sense to us in this instant. So for someone, it may be a sense of love or sense of spirit, but it has to make sense. It has to make sense to us. But it's never, in a way, we're never healers. We're more surrounding the situation to the infinite. And to me, that places us in the right framework of mind to be able to approach prayer. The last point is really about, and that's the substance of prayer, is about the truth that heals. When Jesus says, you shall know the truth, and the truth will make you free, it's those ideas that are specific to the case that help us. So if you talk to people, you look at testimony of healings, you'll find that in a similar situation, different ideas have helped different people. In the case of this woman, in that case, what helped me was really to be a witness to her innocence, that she had not done anything wrong. She was not punished by any means, that she was absolutely innocent, complete, pure, indestructible. And to know that that was her situation, that she was beyond a sense of destructibility. And those were the ideas that were helping me. And in a way, what we do when we have those ideas, we nurture them up to the point where they feel so real that they bring a sense of peace and a sense of joy. But you can see it's not positive thinking. It's really letting those ideas come to us and bring a sense of relief. And to me, a successful prayer is one that brings peace, that we have a sense of peace, regardless of whether the situation has changed or not changed. We have a sense of peace because eventually this peace of mind will have an impact on our life. As I said, our state of consciousness manifests itself in our life. So a sense of peace eventually will see the healing. Sometimes it goes quick. Sometimes it's a bit more work. But I found helpful by keeping the idea of peace in mind that I don't give up. Of course, we all love it much better when we cannot walk, and we pray that way. And then someone shared this recently or earlier today that they had a challenge, and then within the day, it was all healed. They could go out, and of course, this is wonderful, but sometimes we have to be more patient. But again, if we know that the target is not to fix the body, but to find our sense of peace and our sense of our relationship to God, then we stay on the right track, and we don't open ourselves to temptation of impatience. It's all about discovering our true self. It's all about discerning what is tangible, real, beyond the appearance. So in the case of this woman, what was interesting is that she first started by saying that she did not believe in God. And the more we talked, this idea of an infinite source, that her relationship to that source became more and more real to her, sometime without my words. She was just really discovering those ideas for herself. And one day she called and she said that she had no more pain. And then all the symptoms were gone. She had no trace of the growth, and it was all gone. And it's been like that for a while. And she was of course overjoyed, but I can tell that what she gained was a deeper sense of peace. And last time I talked to her, she was telling me that what she does is she's talking to neighbors about it. She's trying to open a little office to help others dealing with challenges, because there are tons of people with challenges. So that's what she was doing. But her main gain was this sense of peace and this sense of this relationship to God. And in a way, you'll find that to me, that's the key idea. It's not about a super drug that, or a magic wand that heals challenges. It goes much deeper. It's going to what is life? What is our purpose? And along the way, yes, we get the healing and the solutions come. The second example I'd like to share is to me even more interesting, because it's something that we used to say that we cannot be reached, and it's a relationship challenge. It's not a physical thing. It's an example from a friend, and this took place 30 years ago. 30 years ago. It is important that it was some time ago, because the situation of the society was different back then. Basically, this friend had just been hired in a HR consulting firm, and she was really, really happy because she got to work directly with the boss of the firm, the founder of the firm. So she got immense coaching. It was really good. But she became to be slightly uncomfortable, which is a small thing. Nothing really bad happened, but just early on, she had lunch with the boss and a male colleague, and the two men were telling dirty jokes about women, in front of her and explaining what they would do if they were sleeping with the waitresses in the restaurant. And she was just at the table, so she was not too comfortable. But again, back then, there was not Me Too movement and stuff, so she didn't know what to do, was the boss, and she was the woman. Anyway, so she let it go. But then as things progressed a bit, then she found that when she was in meetings and the boss was there, he would always sit next to her. And inadvertently, in every single meeting, he was putting his knee against her knee. So she was moving a bit and she was moving away. She would move in a different chair. Same with there was a narrow alley, she explained, where a narrow hole with a the copy machine. And the boss had his office there, and she thought that each time she was making copies, the boss had to scoot by her and squeeze her kind of to go through very, very frequently. So she became to be more and more uncomfortable, and she didn't know what to do. Again, back then, she was not sure what to do. She was afraid to lose her job. She didn't know if she should talk to the boss. So she decided to pray, because she was a reader of the book. I say she would begin to pray. So I hope by now, I don't mean she had a list of things to repeat. No, it was more about changing her thought or being aware to other ideas. And she explained that the idea that came was through a story in the Bible about Daniel in the lion's den, where basically this man ends up in the lion's den, but he's not eaten by the lions in the end. And she found help through this idea, and she found her own innocence. We've talked a lot about innocence, that she was innocent and pure, and she was safe. There was nothing in her that she was creating this, that she was absolutely pure and innocent. So that's the idea that helped her, and she prayed that way. But nothing changed really at the office. And actually, sometime later, they were again having lunch, and the boss was very, I would say stupidly, but was very openly saying that he was looking at women primarily as sexual objects. And in a way, it was a candid declaration. And then he turned to my friend and said, "But hey, Susie, is this the same for you? Is this how you see men?" And so she was horrified. She said no and found a way to leave the lunch. And then she went home. But then it was too much for her. It was just on a slope that was not so healthy. She didn't know if she would go back to work. She didn't feel she could confront and face the boss, so she didn't know. But she gave prayer another try. And I've chosen this example because I felt how she prayed the second time is very, very helpful for all our challenges that are not physical. What she found is that the first time when she prayed, she had this idea of innocence coming to her thought, her deep innocence, and that was somewhat reassuring to her. But what she realized is that she had left in her thought the other guy out. In a way, if I could paint a mental picture of what was happening, so that's my friend's thought. So you have here her, somewhat of a victim, so she prayed about her innocence, so she has a clearer sense of who she is and her innocence. But still there, in her thoughts, still walking around, is the evil man, the crazy man. And that, so, of course, if in our thinking you still have a crazy man, because we experience our state of consciousness, well, you still have it in your life. In order to find a healing, this deep sense of peace has to wipe out any sense of discord in any shape it comes. So the second time she prayed, she realized, and she says, let me think of her word. She says, I don't have a corner on the street for innocence. Like, I don't have a monopoly on innocence. That she felt she was righteous. I'm the innocent one, and he's the evil guy. And so she decided to do, which for those who've done it, it can be hard. She decided to include him in her prayer, to see, to discern the reality about his nature also. In a way, she had to do some work about her, where she could, sometimes we feel, well, why would I do some work? And he's the one who's wrong. Why do I do anything? And so she decided is too strong. She was led to see that he also, at the core of his being, was innocent. That innocence was the very fabric of his being. She was not being naive, or it was not some form of positive thinking. It was a deep spiritual affirmation of the purity of men in general. And with that, she had a deep, deep sense of peace. A deep sense of peace. And she felt really, really peaceful. So peaceful that the next day, there was two things happened. There was no more tension at work, but also she didn't feel afraid anymore. And she didn't feel, do I have to quit the job, talk to him? She just feel a sense of tension going. So she could go to work. And the interesting part is that just a few weeks after, the boss had to go to a big HR conference to gather ideas, helpful ideas that could help the firm. So there would be speakers sharing ideas. So he went alone to this big conference and then came back with the ideas. Then when he came back, he called a staff meeting. The first thing my friend noticed is then during the staff meeting, the boss kept referring to a women speaker in a positive way. He said, well, this woman said this. It was very interesting. But what happened is at the break, my friend overheard her boss talking to another main colleague and saying how during one of the speeches, he found himself being surprised of not thinking sexually about the woman, that he was just listening to the ideas, and even audibly commented that he felt that by thinking differently, he was opening himself to gathering good ideas from women. And from that time on, there was no more challenge at work. She continued working for some time in the firm, and that was the end of it. All the things stopped, and that was over. Again, I don't think that was a coincidence. That somewhat miraculously the guy changed his way of thinking. Neither was it a miracle. To me, I've chosen this healing because it's this resolution because it illustrates the impact, the importance of watching our thinking or what we allow in thought. We are all hit with bad things sometimes, whether it's a physical challenge or anything else, and we can all choose the path of pity, feeling victim, feeling we don't deserve it, all those things. But all those things don't help. Maybe they bring some level of comfort to a degree, but they really don't help. What really helps is when we are able to find, through prayer, sometimes quick, sometimes long time, sometimes just on our own, sometimes by reading. There is no formula there, but just what Jesus was sharing is that our connection to God is always present, and there is always a moment where we can, in a way, reconnect with the infinite. And that connection does bring a change in consciousness. And as we've seen many times now, this change of consciousness does change our experience. And if you think for a second about the impact of this, it's going to be a big idea, but it's even bigger than our life. Because if indeed our state of consciousness does impact our experience, well, when we open the BBC or CNN or anything else with human catastrophes, we have the exact same choice. We can absolutely decide what we allow in our thought or not, and we can make a difference. Or we can make a better contribution to humanity by absolutely refusing to be horrified or even destabilized by what we see on the news, but by really having consistently a higher sense of vision and a higher sense of God in what was happening. It's not about accepting evil or being like ostriches, putting our head in the sand. It's about an active spiritual practice that does bring results. And so suddenly we are active actors instead of being passive contemplator of a world that is not good. So I talked about the book again. To me, the best thing is to look through the book. Those are the main ideas. I was thinking that something that could be helpful is just to talk a bit about what are the critique to the book. Is critique both negative and positive term in English? Yes? Fine? Okay, good. Anyway, so the positive critique the best one I found was from a woman called Clara Barton, who is the founder of the American Red Cross. And she was living at the same time as this author was living, Mary Bicciardi. There were two women, and she was she liked the book, and she felt it was doing lots of good for humanity. So we have lots of quotes about that. And equally, Mary Bicciardi was an admirer of the good that Clara Barton was trying to do, the good she was trying to do for humanity. They were working in different fields in different ways, but they were trying to do good for mankind. So that was, I felt it was a good review. But otherwise, the bottom line is that you'll see it's other readers. You'll see at the end of the book, there's 100 pages of letters printed by readers who explain how they were dealing with some challenges. It's all over the map, maybe physical or something else, maybe a bit more physical at the end of the book, and how they've been healed by reading the book. What I found interesting is that you'll see that some readers are healed without being aware that they could be healed by reading the book, because they were just interested. But again, you see what happened is that the book presents ideas, and if an idea touches you or changes your heart, suddenly that creates a change in consciousness that can result in more harmony in your life. So some readers have found this, which I found very interesting. And today there are still readers that are being healed or helped. So to me, those are the review. As far as the negative critique of the book, I don't know if it's negative. To me, it's more the I would say the most common misunderstanding. And to me, maybe the number one misunderstanding, which I think you'll understand the misunderstanding, is that for a thought that believes that all there is here is atoms, that all there is atoms, then of course the book may be a shock, because the book does take you beyond what seems to be into the nature of what the infinite is. So you could find all types of misunderstanding if you basically have a very materialistic view of the world. The book may make no sense. So that's the main, I would say, the number one. But again, with a clear understanding, that view can change especially when you look into really deep research and you look into quantum physics. If you look at quantum physics, it's very interesting because matter behaves in ways that are completely counterintuitive to our sense of how matter should behave. So to me, I don't know if you've heard about a man called Thomas Kuhn, and he was a professor at Harvard, and he was doing teaching and research in the history of science. And he's the one who popularized a term that we've been using quite a while, which is the paradigm shift. That's this man came out of this man's work. He popularized it. And he studied different sciences, and he explains that new sciences appear when there is an exception. Something that doesn't work is looked into. And he says the anomalies make the new sciences. And he found that there is an established science or understanding of reality, but there is something not quite right, like the way stars used to be calculated. And suddenly it almost works, but a little anomaly. And if you look to the anomaly, you find something else. That's where it talks about paradigm shift. And that explained the big changes. So even to the thought that feel that everything is material, there's all types of anomalies that we can look into in quantum physics just to challenge a bit this assumption. And I think then thought can open itself to a deeper and more spiritual view of the universe. So to me, that's one of the main critics. The other one is maybe sometimes you can find a sense of discomfort with the idea of spiritual healing. Someone who's really used to, in a way, it's kind of related to the first point. If you think the universe is entirely material and that the body is just basically water and potassium and carbon, this idea of spiritual healing may feel bizarre or not possible or strange. But as soon as you realize the impact at minimum of thought on the body, I think thought begins to change. But that's one of the main areas of misunderstanding, is the idea that you could completely find freedom in the largest sense, physically and otherwise, only by spiritual or mental means. That's the second, I would say, the second critique. And the last one is maybe the critique that the book is hard to understand. And to me, it's maybe a misunderstanding or maybe a difference of perspective. If you take, it is a book, so there are many books. But if you take the book as a novel, yeah, it may be hard. Maybe you won't go through all the pages on the beach. Because to me, this book is it's not a magic wand. I mean, I wish, but not the case. It's not a magic wand. It is more like a bulldozer. It's like a bulldozer. It's going to go into your thought and just challenge some conceptions you have. Confirms intuition you had. My favorite discussions are with people sometimes I meet at talks like that, and they say, you know, it's all making sense to me, but you know, I knew all those ideas. I just intuitively knew it. So to me, that's what the book does. It confirms intuition we have. And like a bulldozer, sometimes it goes fast. Sometimes you hit a big rock and it's hard. You have to work at it. But so I don't know if it's hard to understand. It's just the nature of the book is you don't have to start on page one. You can start anywhere you want. Just the idea is not to go in with trying to having an idea and following it. It's really understanding it. It's really what the author says early on. She says it's a book for thinkers. It's about really thinking, logic, what makes sense, and but it won't leave you in the same spot. It is good. I don't know if I've said it already, but when I first engaged with the book, I was really challenging the book a lot and writing on it to see things that were making sense or not. So the book was published a while back in 1875. And I was wondering about Pythagoras' theorem. It was like 2,000 years ago. It still helps build bridges today. So those ideas are still relevant because they're ideas for everyday life. But I was thinking about other resources around the book. So you got the book. You got the last pages. 100 pages are letters sent from readers about the book. But then you have a magazine called the in French, the Herald of Christian Science. In English, you have the Christian Science Sentinel, the Christian Science Journal. And this is quite fantastic because those magazines are not written by journalists or by experts. They are basically written by readers. It's people like you and me who share their experiences, who share their healings, and that pulls together, and that's, in a way, modern readers. That's one resource. You have something else which is called the weekly Bible lesson, which is a weekly, every week there's a different theme that with cross references from Science and Health and the Bible that explore one theme. So it could be man, it could be God, it could be soul, it could be spirit, all types of theme. And every week it changes, and that allows the reader to go and go deep into the two books. And then what else? There are so many, I had to write them down. There are biographies of the author that I found very interesting, because some biographies are very geared towards the healings that she performed. So you see lots of healings. Other biographies are more about her early life. There are biographies written by readers of the book, but also by independent scholars. There is one by Gillian Gill, who is an amazing biography on Agatha Christie, but she wrote a book about Mary Beccaria too with independent research. It's very, very interesting. So you have all types of resources to know more about the author, and they're in English. And what else do you have? I need to have a better handwriting, although I can't read myself. And the other thing you have, which I think is especially relevant today, is a newspaper, and it's called the Christian Science Monitor, and it's news. There is one tiny spiritual article at the end, but it was founded by this woman when she was 80-something, at a time where you started a newspaper at 80. But she felt there was a need for decent, honest, factual journalism. So it's not a religious newspaper at all. It is news. There are editors, journalists. Some of them are readers of the book, others not. But it's about the motto of the it's a daily paper online. It's a weekly magazine. Is to bless mankind, injure no one, and bless mankind. So the idea is to report on what's factual and to see also the good going on in the world. Because sometimes the good going on in the world is left out of the news and we all hear about the bad stuff, but there are really actual good going on. So the newspaper talks about it. And at a time where we've heard all about fake news and those things, I think it's very helpful to have a magazine that we know it's about, not about a political view. It's about just being very factual. So in a way, the readers of the book can pray efficiently for mankind, because if you want to pray for the world and want to have an impact for the world, you need to know what is really going on. If your people tell you one thing and the other news tell you something else, you're misled in your prayer. So that's the Christian Science Monitor, and I'll see if I've not forgotten anything else. Oh yes, the last one. is that, this is all very interesting, that when she, Mary Becciardi, found those ideas, she was healed after being sick for a long time. So she found those ideas. The first thing she did is that she took those ideas to the local churches, because they're spiritual ideas. Say, hey guys, I think, you know, Jesus, she didn't say it that way, it's my words, but you can see, she's something to the effect, hey guys, you know, Jesus was not about creed, about condemnation, punishment. It was about this freedom and this spirituality that actually frees us, makes us better people. It's amazing. And she was hoping that the church would say, oh, amazing. Yeah, you're a woman, but okay, fine. Anyway, wonderful. We'll adopt it. But they just hit the door on her. They would not do anything. So she went on her own with those ideas. People were healed. But what was happening, in a way, is that things were not really organized. So she had to somewhat found a church. But it was, I think, almost 10 years after the publication of the book. And the church, some type of entity just to preserve the book and to publish it. But what was very clear to her, that her organization should completely reflect what she was discovering. And she was not discovering hierarchy. So there is no hierarchy. So basically, I hope I don't offend anyone who belongs to a church, but to me, the church is, I don't say reading book club because it's really bad, but it's people coming together to study those ideas, to read the book, to share ideas, but you will not find someone or hopes, not someone telling you you should do this or that, or not any more than anywhere else. But the whole structure is just to be together. So they meet on Sunday to, there are some readings, there is structure of the readings, but the idea is being together. But everyone's path is just individual. And on Wednesday, I find it interesting too, they have a meeting to where there's some readings of the sign of the book and of the Bible. And then the meeting is open for whoever wants to stand and share a healing they had, explain how they prayed, and in a very, very, very casual way. So that's another resources. So you got the book, and you got tons of ideas to help you practice the book. And I got here on my piece of paper, I-975, which is the name of the number for the booth upstairs. So there's a book with the book upstairs, and it's on aisle I, where there is the book. There are free magazines, so you can go by and. There are people, they're readers of the book there, so you can talk to them, see what makes sense to them, and maybe ask questions. I think it's very interesting to see everyone's path is different, and I'm sure you'll learn some good ideas. So I think that's all I had for today. So a big thank you for your attention.